As you turn to Acts chapter 19, verses 40 and 41, the verses which will help us close out the chapter. It's been 2 weeks since we were there, so let's refresh our minds just a bit. We know that there was the temple to Diana there. The people thought that that was really important for them. The temple, in their mind, provided a lot of different blessings. And they thought that Paul was a threat to that because his preaching, not that he was preaching directly against the goddess, but he was telling people, I want to tell you about the living God, and that was directing people away from the people who were making the silver shrines and so forth. The temple was not getting the kind of business that it had been getting. That disturbed the people. There's this riot, and then you have the town clerk showing up trying to calm things down. With that in mind, let's again look at Acts chapter 19, verses 40 and 41. This is the town clerk speaking. For indeed we are in danger to be accused concerning this day's riot, there being no cause for it. And as touching it, we shall not be able to give account of this concourse. And when he had thus spoken, he dismissed the assembly. Now this guy, I told you, he's kind of like the chief executive officer. If someone gets to that position, that role in life, we would expect them to be at least fairly effective in the job. They know how to handle people. They know how to handle situations. And this guy handled the crowd in a masterful way. He tells the people, you can back up a little bit, that they need to calm down. He says, look, back there in verses 34 and 35, everybody knows that the goddess is great. Everybody knows that it's revered by all. We can't question this particular thing. It reminds me of a politician today. You know, gets up and doesn't necessarily speak the truth, but wants to placate the people, wants to make sure that everything is, you know, everything looks smooth, and hey, don't worry about it. It's all under control. We don't have a crisis, and everything's going to be okay.
Everybody says so.
Yeah, that's about it. It may not be true. Yes, it may be completely false, but they will go ahead and they want to put up that message. Well, you can imagine that if you've got people stirred up, that's not going to be good under any set of circumstances. So this kind of thing has been going on for a long, long time. He does make the point in verse 37 that Paul had not been involved with any kind of criminal activity. No Christian had been doing that kind of thing. They were just preaching a particular message. And verse 38, to back up a little bit there as well, he said if they have a grievance, if there's something that they think that needs litigated, they've got the courts, they can go to different officials there and see what the options are. And if those options are not available, it can also be addressed at a later assembly, verse 39. He says, though, that if this riot does not disperse, kind of like today, we've seen some of the rioting on TV, and you hear the warnings from the police, disperse or what? All right, and the action could be we're going to tear gas, or we're going to bring out the batons, or we're going to bring out the water cannons. We're going to do something that's probably not going to be a good outcome for the people who are involved with the riot. Well, they didn't have water cannons and tear gas back then, but he said there is a danger. He said we are in danger, we're at risk of being accused of having a mob-like gathering which has no cause, there's no basis, we can't give a valid reason for this. The point is, at the end of verse 40, if this information gets back to Rome, things are not going to go well. They were a free city, they had certain blessings, they had certain privileges because of that, and I think we gave the illustration before as we were starting to tentatively look at this. It's like a child. If the child at 16 has a driver's license and has access to a car, and that child proves to you, the parent, that he or she is not responsible, chances are, what's going to happen?
Take the car away.
All right, take the car away. And the message probably is, you're going to get the keys back if and when you do. When what happens? You become responsible when we can trust you again. But if this is how you're going to behave, we're going to yank the leash, so to speak, and you're not going to have your privileges. Well, that works with adults as well. And the Romans certainly would not have been interested in this kind of thing as far as mobs. And the emperor gets word of that, and it would be very easy for him to say, okay, the blessings that they have, they're going to be revoked. When you begin to see that so much was at stake, and this was really a capital offense, if the people did not dismiss the assembly, verse 41. And I will give you this quick point. You've probably heard this said by different preachers at times, different Bible class teachers. The word here that is translated assembly is elsewhere rendered church in Acts chapter 19. So this is not a case where he was dismissing the church as we think about the word, but there was this assembly. There was these people had been, they'd come together. There was this calling out for this great crowd, and he says, now it's time for you to go home. This is an unauthorized assembly. I think that's kind of interesting as far as a little footnote. Not all assemblies are authorized, either in the eyes of the world or perhaps even in the eyes of God. I wonder a little bit, I'm not too optimistic about that, but I wonder a little bit, if when the people go home, they start perhaps thinking about, we got into that big ruckus over a God that's not a living God, but probably they didn't give it that much thought, but that would have been a thoughtful thing to think about. All right, we can never be sure as far as the providence of God. Doug White, when he was here last week, talked about what happened to him, and I think that as you look at that, you have to say, wow, it sure seems that the providence of God was there. But here's another example of that. The chief executive officer, he happens to be there or is able to come. He happens to say the right things. The crowd is willing to respond to that. When you think about Demetrius's speech, that incited the riot, and then, of course, the town clerk is able to end that, and there is no miracle associated with the people ceasing and desisting. So the town clerk does a great job, and again, probably the right man at the right time, and that bails some Christians out. Anything that you want to add or ask before we move into Acts chapter 20? Stan, we'll start with you.
Well, Demetrius shot himself in the foot. Because when you look at it, to begin with, he calls them all together, and he says, you know that this by this craft we have our wealth. So he's a silversmith. He's talking about what they and how they make their money. And, of course, the Temple of Diana was a big part of it because they were making statues and whatever. But somewhere in there, whether he did it intentionally or not, he shifted it from they're messing with our income, which he might have had a case, to the fact that they're now against Diana. He's moved. Mm-hmm. It's moved away from the way they make their money over to the fact that he's against their religion, and that then the councilman or whatever it was,
town clerk, yeah,
town clerk could say, "What's the deal here?"
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm going to come back to that. You raise an excellent point, which we see time and time again in the world, but we'll take George's hand first.
Well, I think, Stan, I think what he's doing there, you have the initial appeal to something concrete, something tangible. He's affecting our income. All right, everybody can get on board with that. But there are people from within your own group who can affect your income, and you treat them differently, most likely, at least human history shows, you treat them differently than you treat someone who is among the other who's affecting your income. So he starts by saying, okay, they're affecting our income, let's get together for that reason. And then he positions them as people who are outside our belief system. See, we form societies based on a common belief system. Now they're outside our belief system, and they're affecting our income. They're not even part of us. So we don't need to deal with them in a civilized manner. Let's just get the problem handled. We see that, you saw that in the lynchings across the American South in parts of in the early 20th century. You see that around the world when one group goes to war with another group who has different beliefs. You see the savagery with which they treat them because they are of the other. We can suddenly regard them as something other than us, not fully human in the way that we are. It's a really smart move on his part if he wants to whip up the crowd to do something.
Yeah, it is. The risk, though, and this we'll go back to something that Sam was saying, people can often overplay their hand. We see it all the time in the world. You see the child who gets sick. Mom and dad says, oh, you know, have my tonsils out. Oh, I can't work for 3 months. Well, mom and dad say, no, wait a minute. You know, maybe for the first week we can be sympathetic. But when we get into week two, hey, buddy, you're going to have to go out and start mowing the lawn again and making your bed and all the other things. What do we call that? Well, that's one expression of it. That's not the one I was thinking of. A person takes advantage of the situation, or what do you drink? There we go. I figured somebody would get that. We're milking it, right? Here's a person who says, I can't, or I won't, or whatever, and they maximize it. Politicians do that as well. You see that they will object to something, and maybe it's a legitimate objection, maybe it's a real problem, but they start here, but instead of staying here, where do they end up? They end way up over there. And it can be done by speakers as well. If you are a public speaker, you have to be wary of that. You might start going, and then all of a sudden, you know, you should have stayed right over here, but you kind of got carried away, and we talk about that sometimes. Well, he got carried away, and he ended way up there, which is not a good place. So you do see both of those things here, and it really is a good illustration of humanity. Anybody else before we look at Acts 21 and 2? Okay, let's jump down there now. And, so continuing the thought, and after the uproar ceased, Paul, having sent for the disciples and exhorted them, took leave of them and departed to go into Macedonia. And when he had gone through those parts and had given them much exhortation, he came to Greece. When I look at the opening words of this chapter, I think that that could possibly be turned into a sermon. You think about the uproar ceasing for a lot of people in a lot of different places. Uproars in work? Uproars in a workplace? Yeah. Uproars in the home? Uproars in a neighborhood? I mean, we live in a time where we still have a lot of uproars. Just turn on the TV or look at the newspaper or pull up your smartphone app. What about uproars in the church? Congregations have that kind of thing? It's all around us. So when we look at Acts chapter 19, Acts chapter 20, this kind of stuff is not new. Well, as you think about an uproar, we obviously know what that is and how common that is. But as you look at Acts chapter 19, what would you say is a good response to an uproar? Well, even well, you can even, let's ask a different question. What would be a bad response to an uproar?
Getting entangled.
All right, I think that's probably the best answer. If you have this problem, and people are sometimes tempted just to jump on board. Well, hey, if there are 100 people out there, I'll add voice number 101. I'll go join the group. Well, that's probably not going to quiet things down. The sensible, rational, and we would say the logical and biblical approach would be what? Well, okay, we would hopefully want to be controlled in our response, do what's right. Anything else? As you think about the example of the town clerk, what did he do?
He stayed rational.
All right, he stayed calm, and then when there was an opportunity to speak to the people logically, he said, well, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then over here, point number 5, if we don't go home, guess what? There are going to be some really bad consequences. And you may not be able to convince everybody in the crowd, but if you could convince 25%, do you think that's probably going to quiet things down a little bit? Yeah. And then after the 25% are willing to drift away, well, then maybe it's 30, and then maybe it's 40, and then you may have some of the old diehards who are going to hang around for a little while, but eventually it all begins to come apart. And when rational minds, when thoughtful people can begin to respond, that's a good way to deal with things. One source noted, and like I said, I'm going to give you the quote here for the most part because it's not my material. I didn't come up with this. But he noted how Ephesus is gone and so is the worldwide temple of Diana. The city, the silversmiths that Stan was talking about, they're all gone. But what's not gone when it comes to Ephesus? All right, we've still got information about God and His Word. We think, for example, about the book of Ephesians. We think about 1 and 2 Timothy. Timothy spent some time there. We think about the church that we read about in Revelation chapter 2, verses 1 through 7. The name of Demetrius is pretty much in the dust. Had it not been for the Bible, we probably wouldn't have known about the man. But the name Paul, that's still around. As Carol mentioned, the gospel is still there. You even wonder, Demetrius might not have ever made history had he not met up with Paul, or at least known about Paul. When you look at the Christians at Ephesus, and we've talked a little bit about this before, you find that this was a congregation that was a strong church. It was a good church, and it did eventually have some problems, but it was a well-taught church. But in spite of that, what does Paul do before he moves along? The uproar ceases, Paul sends for the disciples, and what's he do? He exhorts them. Even for strong churches, do you think that there's still a need to encourage and to strengthen God's people?
Yes.
There is. In our cases, we think about a congregation, and perhaps it's made up of Christians who have been Christians for 30, 40, 50, 60 years. I had a teacher one time, and it was one of the better pieces of advice. I think I got a lot of good advice going through school, but one of the better pieces of advice, at least this is struck with me, he said, for your older saints, you know, they don't need to hear about faith, repentance, confession, and baptism every Sunday. They pretty much got that down. But do you think that there are some times where it's still good for those Christians to hear those basic truths? They believe the stuff. I mean, it's kind of like saying, I love you, after you've been married for 50 years. Let's say that you've heard from your spouse, I love you 10,000 times. Well, don't you think that's enough to kind of get the message?
Well,
I was trying to hold you down.
Oh.
So, don't you think that's enough to kind of get the message after 10,000 times?
I want 11.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. I've had 10,000 times. Well, we're going to still go ahead and put that in there to let you know that. All right, Gary. Sorry, I didn't mean to chop you off right there.
That's right. It's like we were talking about recently. It's good to put the reason why someone chose to be baptized on their baptismal certificate, because mm-hmm. even after a while, those thoughts can...
Yes.
You can be looking at them differently. You could just not remember fully, you know. And so, yeah, the basics need to be reminded of.
Some reassurance is good. I was within my first year of military service, and I was working for a tech sergeant. He took me to lunch one day, and he said, I want you to know that you're doing a good job. I said, well, thanks. Now, he said, don't expect me to bring you to lunch very often and tell you that you're doing a good job. I said, well, okay. And that was the only time. I was there for about a year, and that was the only time that I remember him telling me, you're doing a good job, and we had lunch together. But he made the point, it's kind of like, I'm not going to tell you I love you a lot. I mean, if there's a problem, I'll let you know. But this is kind of the once I love you, and you're kind of good for this, unless maybe we're there for another year or two. But anyway, he understood that for a newer airman, it was good to offer some reassurance. Parents do that with kids, don't they? Don't you think parents love their kids and kids realize that? But still, before they go out the door, what? I love you. Yeah, I know. They might say that, they might respond in that way, but still, it's good for them to hear that. Anything that you want to add or ask about that before we move down a little further? Stan?
What's the reason for this being here?
Well, I think a couple things. It might show that in spite of this being a good congregation, you're talking about Paul strengthening the church, right?
Well, this incident with Demetrius and Grayson Gain and whatever, because he's the... He causes the problem, raises an uproar, gets everybody all whatever, and then it dies down, and we go on. I'm just kind of wondering why it's there. What's Luke trying to get across to us by putting that incident in there?
So we're not on the encouragement part. We're there with Demetrius. Which one? Or both?
Well, I'm just curious as to why that incident is in there. At what point does it make?
As far as Demetrius the silversmith?
Yeah.
I think it, among other things, shows the effectiveness of Paul's work. It shows that there was opposition. It shows that the Christians were able to come through that. They were able to weather that storm. I'm thinking, too, that it helps illustrate some of the things that Paul had to deal with. Those would be the three or four top reasons that I think I could give for.
Yeah. But it what made me think of that question was there was no resolution to it.
Not really, no.
And then to go back even further, you ask how do you deal with an uproar? And I think Carol said that you don't get entangled in it, and that's true. But by the same token, you don't ignore it.
No.
And it almost seems as if in this particular case, it was ignored. If you get to the end of the incident, Demetrius is still in the same position he was in.
Correct.
To start with.
Yeah, the problem is not really solved.
Yeah.
They put a Band-Aid on it, and it's if you want to litigate this in the courts, you have that option. But we would assume, even after Paul leaves, the preaching continues. People are still going to be diverted. They're not going to be going to the Temple of Diana because they're becoming Christians. This church continues. We would expect that it continues to grow. So there are some things that people sometimes just learn to live with. I'm inclined to think that that's probably what happened here. Demetrius did the very best he could. I think he overplayed his hand some, and he went, as George said, into some other areas. And when that failed, it's kind of like, if I can't skin the cat this way, maybe there were some other things that they did. But still, you know, he went for broke, and he went broke. It did not work. Okay, looking at some other things here, as far as Paul, he's sent for the disciples, he's exhorted them, then he takes leave of them, he decides that he's going to go into Macedonia. Let's run a couple of references here. One you're probably familiar with, the other one probably not so much. These are both going to come from 2 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians chapter 11, we'll ask somebody to read 2 Corinthians 11:28, and then we'll move into that next chapter and read 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 20 and 21. Paul, as he thought about his work, he was concerned about all the churches, but in the area of Macedonia, he had some extra concerns, we might say. 2 Corinthians 11:28. Gary will be a reader for that, and Steve will ask you to move into the next chapter, 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 20 and 21. Gary, and here's the one that's probably familiar to us.
beside those things that are without, that which cometh upon me daily, the care of all the churches.
Okay, Paul, he says, every congregation is on my mind. I'm concerned about all the churches. He'd personally been to some of them. He's already sent, if we back up into Acts chapter 19 and verse 22, we find that he's already sent Timothy and Erastus into Macedonia, apparently to help out with some issues there. He's got some concerns that maybe they can focus on, but Paul is still thinking broadly. He's thinking there are a lot of places that are really having some issues. And as we start looking in the New Testament, you find the Judaizers that we had back in Acts chapter 15 over in the book of Galatians, and then you've got the Gnostic heresies. I mean, there's a lot of stuff floating around out there. And when we look at our time, we still have some concerns about congregations because there's a lot of bad stuff. Steve, let's move you into that second chapter, 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 20 and 21. Let's see what we have there.
For I fear lest when I come, I shall not find you such as I wish, and that I shall be found by you such as you do not wish, lest there be contentions, jealousies, outbursts of wrath, selfish ambitions, backbitings, whisperings, conceits, tumults, lest when I come again, my God will humble me against you, and I shall mourn for many who have sinned before and have not repented of the uncleanness, fornication, and lewdness which they have practiced.
All right, now Paul, now let me just kind of summarize that verse, or those two verses. Paul says, if I show up, if I darken the door at Corinth, when I walk in there, what kind of congregation might I find? Everything is fine and dandy, or I'm going to find some major issues. I'm going to find that there are people who are involved with sexual sin. I'm going to find that there are backbiters. I'm going to find that there are gossips. I'm going to find that there are people who are stirring up trouble. I really don't want to come. And Paul says, if I do come, are you going to want me there? No, because I'm not going to endorse those kinds of things. I'm going to be telling you that you need to repent. If you know that there's a congregation where all this stuff is going on, 2 Corinthians 12, verses 20 and 21, you think that's going to bother you a little bit? You think about someone who has family members, and you think about what's going on with the family. You think, well, you know, the husband is involved with all these bad things, or the wife is involved with all these bad things, or they have teenage kids, and the teenage kids are involved with all these bad things. And you can list five or six things like you have in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 20 and 21. Are you going to be, if you love that family, are you going to be concerned about those relatives?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably going to be on your mind day in and day out. I mean, they're involved with this behavior, and they're not right with God, and it's dangerous behavior. They're going to hurt their body. They might be killed because they don't have their senses about them. Well, if you've got several congregations that have several issues, you can understand what Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 28, there is this pressure on me daily for the churches. Now let's go back to Acts chapter 20. He talks about in verse 2 the parts, or some translations might say the districts. Macedonia was divided into multiple districts. And the end of verse 1 says that Paul offered much exhortation to Christians in those areas. He'd wanted to do that, Acts chapter 19 and verse 21. Now if you have a map, if you don't, there's still some in the back, I think. Paul was talking about places like Philippi and Thessalonica and Berea. Paul told this the Corinthians, 2 Corinthians 7 and verse 5, that trip, when he made it, finally had a lot of unpleasantness for him, and we can understand why. Then finally, as we look at verse 2, the text tells us that Paul came to Greece. What else do I want to tell you? As you look back at the preceding chapter, Acts 19 and verse 22, I mentioned this before, you have Paul sending Timothy and Erastus into Macedonia. They were kind of an advanced team. That still happens today. A person with the president, he has his advanced team go out, the Secret Service, and sometimes people today will send out an advanced team for some reason. Paul begins to learn about some of the problems at Corinth. You begin to find, as you look at 1 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 7, and then later in the book, 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verses 10 and 11, that as Timothy is headed here, Paul knows about all the problems. Timothy is this younger preacher, so Paul writes to the Corinthians and says, when Timothy shows up, how do you guys need to treat him? Pretty well. You think as a young preacher, Timothy might have wanted to tear into some of those issues? You know, he goes there and he finds some people living in fornication, and, you know, he sees the gossip and the backbiting and all the other terrible sins. I think that could have been a tempting thing for him, and he's being sent there to help the folks at Corinth, and Paul says, treat him well. Well, the Corinthians, apparently were not too pleased with Paul in his letter. So as you look at 2 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 14, 2 Corinthians 13 verses 1 and 2, their negative reaction caused Paul to take a quick trip to Corinth. So he's traveling, going a lot of different places. He finally ends up in Troas. He's looking for Titus as well. Can't find Titus. That's difficult for him to deal with as well. And he might have found Titus in either Thessalonica or Philippi. But Titus is eventually found, and he gives him some news. And this news is found in 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 5 through 11. I know I'm kind of highlighting some of this stuff, but we'll at least pull out some of the references which I think are especially key. Let's head over there and read that as well. 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 5 through 11. And then we'll take a look at 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 10. And then we'll have 2 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 1 read as well. Let's get our readers lined up. 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 5 through 11. Who wants that one? Gary, back to you. Then we'll take a look at 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 10. Who would like that one? 2 Corinthians 10 verse 10, that'll be Carol. And then we'll take a look at 2 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 1. Who would like that one? 2 Corinthians 3 verse 1. Bonnie. Let's start with 2 Corinthians 2, 5 through 11. Gary?
But if any have caused grief, he that hath not grieved me, but in part, that I may not overcharge you all. Sufficient to such a man is the punishment which is inflicted of many. So that, contrarywise, ye ought rather to forgive him and comfort him, lest perhaps such a one should be swallowed up with overmuch sorrow. Wherefore I beseech you that ye would confirm your love toward him. For to this end also did I write, that I might know the proof of you, whether ye be obedient in all things. To whom ye forgive anything, I forgive also. For if I forgave anything, to whom I forgave it, for your sakes forgave I it in the person of Christ, lest Satan should get an advantage of us, for we are not ignorant of his devices.
Okay, now this ties in with 1 Corinthians 5, where you have this man living with his father's wife. I mean, apparently this is open fornication. Everybody in the church knows about it, and they're maybe even bragging about it. Hey, you know, look at how nice we are. Look at how accepting and loving and tolerant we are. And it's just outrageous. Paul said not even the Gentiles would accept that kind of stuff. You know, who do you are as a Christian thinking that you can pull that kind of thing? Well, now the Corinthians, you know, they've got some help there coming from Timothy, and they've got some communication from Paul. And now with the reading that Gary read, it looks like they've pulled back. They've tried to tighten things up a little bit, and Paul says that's good. So I'm not there. I don't understand all the details, but if you've made some progress, you know, I'm commending you for that. And if this guy has stopped his sin, accept him back into fellowship. That's certainly what I would do. So you've made some improvements, so to speak. We often talk about the 1 Corinthian letter and all the issues that you find in it. I mean, it's just chapter after chapter after chapter, and that's true. But now we're starting to see from the book of Acts that Paul is kind of behind the scenes, if you will, working, trying to sort out some of those issues. But not everybody likes that. In 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 10, that next passage that we want read, we have this said. Let's have that read now. 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 10. All right, here are some people associated with Corinth who look at Paul and they don't like him very much. They say, oh, when it comes to letter writing, would you give Paul an A?
Yes.
Boy, he writes great letters. But he shows up, what's he like in the pulpit?
D.
Boy, that guy is a dud. I mean, he is a loser. You don't want to listen to him. Well, if you're Paul and you're trying to sort this stuff out at Corinth, and you know that there are people who say, oh yeah, you get a letter from him, that's really impressive, but you know what he's like. He's not that great of a speaker. His personal appearance, you know, not really a handsome guy, you know, doesn't dress the best. How are you going to feel? I mean, it's like you're trying to help somebody today, and you've got people bad-mouthing you. They say, oh, that's a terrible helper. He doesn't know anything. He's unqualified. I asked him for help, and he couldn't assist me. You'd be outraged. And that's what Paul's dealing with. Carol?
Instead of the message, all they're looking at is the appearance.
Yes.
The
messenger versus the message. 2 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 1. Let's pick this up as well.
Do we begin again to commend ourselves? Or need we, as some others, epistles of commendation to you, or letters of commendation from you?
Okay. Paul has this issue on top of everything else. There were some people who showed up and they said, look, we've got our letter of commendation. Listen to us. We've got the paper behind our name. It wouldn't be quite equivalent to this, but the person shows up and says, I've got a PhD in theology. Listen to me. Well, did Paul have his PhD in theology certificate? He didn't. So here are these people that come to Corinth and say, look, we're certified. You know, we had the board, if you will, trying to put this in more modern terms. The board authorized us to come and preach. Where's Paul's board certification? But Paul says, I don't have those kinds of credentials. Well, you can imagine what the opponents would have done with that, right? They would have seized on that. They would have jumped on that and said, well, look, we've got these letters of commendation. He doesn't have any. Therefore, you should listen to us. Paul has to say, well, I don't have any letters of commendation, but I do have this. I'm what? I am an apostle who was personally appointed by Jesus Christ. These are my credentials. Now, if you want to stack my credentials up with theirs, you're going to have to make an evaluation. But Paul said, I'm the one who has been authorized by God. Galatians chapter 1 and verse 1 would be a good cross-reference for that. Now, Titus, as I said, meets up with Paul. Paul's been searching for him. They finally meet up. And then Paul decides that he's going to have another letter sent to the Corinthians. That would be this book that we've been talking about, the 2 Corinthian letter. And then after that letter was written, 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 16 through 19, Paul has Titus and two other Christians take this letter to the Corinthians. Now, we don't know who went with Titus. It may have been Luke. It may have been Tychicus. It may have been Timothy. We don't know. But Paul, he again intends to come to Corinth, but before he does that, he wants to continue to collect some funds. You remember the great collection from 1 Corinthians chapter 16? This is also part of this time period. Paul's traveling, he's visiting some congregations and trying to get some things worked out. And in the midst of this, he's trying to help the Corinthians, got all these burdens. We have one more little issue that we want to toss in here, and this comes from 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 15 and 16. Anybody still close to the 2 Corinthians letter? And Gary, you? Okay. Let's have you read verses 15 and 16.
Which chapter was it?
2 Corinthians 1.
And in this confidence, I was minded to come unto you before, that ye might have a second benefit, and to pass by you into Macedonia, and to come again out of Macedonia unto you, and of you to be brought on my way toward Judea.
Okay, Paul tells the Corinthians, as far as the second benefit, I'd plan on coming to see you twice. Be like going on a trip. And you tell a person, I like you, I want to spend time with you, we're going to on a trip, we're going to stop and see you on the way down, and we're going to stop and see you on the way back. But Paul says, because of all the stuff that's taken place, I've got all these bad accusations swirling against me, and you've not received my letter very well, and there are all kinds of problems. He said, I'm only going to see you one time. He originally planned to leave Ephesus, come to Corinth, spend the winter there, go to Macedonia, and come back to Corinth before he eventually goes to Jerusalem with a great collection. That was the plan. But he says, 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 15, he was only going to make one trip and did. Well, to let you have some insight as far as how poorly Paul was treated at times, the Corinthians used that against him. Did you pick it up from 2 Corinthians chapter 1? What were some saying? Let's have you read verse 15, Gary.
And in this confidence I was minded to come unto you before, that ye might have a second benefit.
Okay. He says that he didn't do that, and maybe I want 2 Corinthians 1, 17. I was looking for the word fickle in some versions.
Yeah, that's
17. Okay, let's read 17 too.
When I therefore was thus minded, did I show fickleness? Or the things that I purpose, do I purpose according to the flesh, that with me there should be yea, yea, and nay, nay?
Okay, think about a child. You have plans, and you tell the child, we're going to do this. But something happens. You know, maybe the child misbehaves, and you don't do that. Or you say, we're going to do this twice, and you only do it once. What's the reaction from the child? What's the child say?
You said we were going to
That's
do
exactly
this.
That's exactly it. We you promised, you said, and you didn't do it. Well, that's what some people were doing at Corinth. You said you were going to come twice, you only came once. Therefore, you not only don't have letters of recommendation, and you're not only a poor preacher, what else is true? You go back on your word. You're unreliable. We don't want to listen to you. Now, can you imagine Paul? I mean, this is on your mind every day. You're trying to help these people out, and this is the way that you're being treated. It's like a doormat being trod upon day after day after day. This is all the background that we have in Acts chapter 20 and the Corinthian letter. So he, when you look at his life, you have to say he was really, really committed, because he was pounded in a lot of different ways and treated very, very poorly. Anything you want to add or ask? Okay, let's move down to Acts chapter 20, verse 3. And when he had spent 3 months there, and a plot, out of all the other stuff, in addition to all the other stuff that we've looked at, now he's got a plot against him. A plot was laid against him by Jews as he was about to set sail for Syria. He determined to return through Macedonia. He's got about 3 months that he spends in the area of Greece, and now he's ready to set sail for Syria. Once again, you have to keep in mind that he's doing all these travels, stopping at these congregations, picking up money to help the poor saints in Jerusalem. He spent about a year doing that. He's already encouraged the Christians in Macedonia and Achaia. Romans 15 and verse 25 would be a cross-reference for that. He's encouraged them to help with that great collection, and now he realizes that there were some Jews who had laid a plot against him. Now Luke, unlike what Stan had mentioned as far as all the details in Acts chapter 19 with the riot, Luke does not really give us any information about this plot. But there's a little information there that I think you can kind of put perhaps a few of the pieces together. You have the word plot used in conjunction with the word sail. Now, if you're going to kill somebody, or you're going to dispense with somebody, and they're in a ship, how might you do it? I think that's probably one of the easiest ways to do it. Now, when you think about a cruise ship today, I don't know, how many people are on a cruise ship, larger cruise ship? A couple thousand?
Yeah.
Okay, so you have 2,000 people. Might be a little difficult to find passenger X. But if you've got a ship, in ancient times, you think it's going to be difficult to find passenger Paul? Probably not. And you think it's probably going to be difficult to dump the guy over on one of the ancient ships? No. And maybe you do it at night. Oh, he disappeared? Must have taken a midnight stroll. I mean, this would have been a very, very easy thing to do. Don't know exactly who the Jews were, but certainly they must not have been people who were very interested in the gospel of Christ. Well, Paul learns about the plot. And how he learns about it, we don't know. Maybe there were some people who told him about it. Maybe this was a divine message from God. But he does come to understand that there is this plot. He begins to, he changes his plans. He begins to realize that he has to go in a different way. So he goes north into Macedonia, crosses the Aegean Sea. You can see that in the map, to Asia Minor, and finds his transportation there. That delay probably prevented him from getting to Jerusalem in time for the Passover meal, but he was able to get to Jerusalem in time for Pentecost, and that's what we're going to see in verse 16. Anything you want to look at before we start saying some things about verse 4? Okay, let's go ahead, and we've got about 5 minutes left, at least introduce verse 4. We're going to have seven men described in Acts chapter 20 and verse 4. It looks like, to me, I can't say this definitively, but remembering this great collection, we're coming from a lot of Gentile congregations to help Jews there in the area of Jerusalem. And it's like today. You have perhaps a delegation of people coming together, and they would say, well, this person is from this company, or this person is from this region, and we have somebody over here who represents this place. It would have made sense, if you're going to have a huge collection, to have Christians from multiple congregations to actually go with the funds and be present in Jerusalem. I think it's also significant that if you have representatives from these congregations, and they were Gentiles, and they show up at a Jewish congregation, or they show up in Jerusalem to help Christians who are from a Jewish background, that certainly could have helped things in a lot of ways. I will tell you this, let's pick up with 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 20 and 21, going back to that book as well for just a minute. Why they chose seven men may also be reflected in this passage. 2 Corinthians chapter 8, 20 and 21. Somebody have it and want to read? All right, Lois, to you. Thank you.
Taking precaution that no one, should discredit us in our administrations of this generous gift. For we have regard for what is honorable, not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men.
Okay, Paul said, I want to be ethical. I want to be ethical in the sight of God. I want to be ethical in the sight of men. Now, I don't know how much money they collected, but we're going to come back to that in a second. Let's say that they've collected $1 million. If I give you $1 million, and I think you're a trustworthy person, but I give you $1 million, and expect for you to go, you know, hundreds of miles away to deliver that $1 million to some others? You think that could raise some questions in the mind of somebody? You know, thinking, well, okay, especially without email and phone, you know, maybe you show up with $800,000. You know, maybe the guy pockets $200,000. You never know. So how could you get the $1 million from place A to place B and feel comfortable that everything was above board, that there was no impropriety?
Send some other people.
All right, send some other people. So you pick up seven guys from different places and you say, we're going to have this as well. Now, that could have been useful for some other reasons, too. You think they could have just written him a $1 million check? You collect all this money, you put it in the bank, and get a check, and okay, Jerusalem Christians, here's your $1 million check.
They want cash.
Oh, right. They didn't have checks back in that day and time. You probably would have had silver and gold. Well, I don't know about you, but one guy carrying $1 million, that's just the figure that we're using, one guy carrying $1 million in gold, I don't want that to be me. I mean, there's no way that you can carry that in your person, so here you've got your donkey out there, and now if you're doing that, what happens? You're a target for robbers. I remember a guy many years ago, congregation trusted him to take about $25,000 into Russia. They were going to buy some property for the church. And I talked to that man later, and he said, I was scared stiff. He was concerned not only from an ethical standpoint, I think he was an elder, I'm not positive about that, but he said, I was concerned from it as far as an ethical standpoint, but also robbery. Can you imagine? You go into a country like that. I mean, it's kind of difficult to find to hide $25,000 in cash. You know, even if you do it in $100 bills, you can do the math and think that's a lot of cash to stash, and you really don't want that in the luggage. What happens if somebody, his pocket's a little extra padded, and you get robbed? Well, now you got to come back to the States and say, well, I was robbed of $25,000. Well, you know, you hopefully would have confidence in the man and say, well, yes, we believe that. We're going to try again or whatever. But he said that was almost terrifying to me. But he actually did that. So there have been Christians who have tried to help people, and sometimes they've had to carry great sums of money. And that is a complication even in our time. Paul in Galatians chapter 2 and verse 10 said, I am zealous to help the poor. He was enthused about this. And there's a reason for that. Why was Paul so interested in helping the poor? Think he was just a really compassionate guy, or maybe something else? Well, I think there is that. But anything else? When you go back and you start looking at how he'd behave, Acts chapter 8 and verse 3, Acts 22 verses 4 and 5, Galatians chapter 1 and verse 13, how had Paul persecuted the church? He said, if it was a man or if it was a woman, I drug him off to jail. I persecuted him. What happens if you put mom and dad in jail? Well, that is going to be a crisis for the children. What happens if mom and dad are killed because of your persecution? Now you've got some orphans out there. I suspect that Paul carried some guilt with him for a long time because of the persecution. So a person says, I can't go back and bring mom and dad back from the dead. But what can I do? I have affected some people. They might have lost their job because of me. Their family might have been torn apart because of me. It's kind of like today as far as financial compensation. You have somebody who's killed in an automobile wreck. You have somebody who is injured for life. The court cannot, the lawyer can't bring the person back from the dead, but they can do what? They can say, we're going to help monetarily. There's going to be some financial compensation. That's the best that we can do. And it seems to me that may not have been the sole factor, but I do believe that is a contributing factor as far as understanding Paul and why he wanted to spend so much effort on this.